You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the podcast for Lotus Eaters for Thursday, the 6th of March, 2025. I'm joined by Harry and Kelly J. Keane, and we're going to be talking about the new phenomenon of the trans English. That's why I got you on, to be honest. How the official state religion of Britain appears to actually be Islam at the moment.
Ah, beautiful.
Yeah, which another just so quintessentially English thing. And how multiculturalism has been nothing but a basket of roses and flowers and sweets and
very
chocolates.
Happy notes.
It's going
to
be such.
I didn't want it to end this way, but.
Yeah, it's going to be such a jolly over. Segment. It's going to be so nice.
It's over. Nice.
Yeah. So, anyway, so there's been a new phenomenon in Britain, in particular England at the moment, where a bunch of people who are clearly not ethnically English have been like, I'm English, you know. It's like, right, that's a very strange thing. Why are we doing this exactly? Why are we suddenly pretending like everyone who's here is just English because they live in this country?
I reckon if you dilute what it means to be English, then anyone can be English, therefore no one is English.
That's kind of where this is going. Mm. Then we're kind of deprived of our own identities.
I would argue that that's the point.
Yeah.
Which a cynical person might argue. However,
as Stelios pointed out the last time we discussed this is only ever directed towards people of European ethnicities. You would not make these kinds of arguments with Indians or Chinese or Japanese people.
I don't know. I think
maybe the Japanese, given that they're trying to diversify that country at the moment.
I don't know. I mean, I'm a big fan of Indian poetry, like Rudyard Kipling.
True.
So, you know, India's greatest poet. Anyway, before we go on, we've been refused monetization for some reason on the YouTube channel. So if you're watching this on YouTube, come over to lotuseats.com, sign up for £5 a month. Support us, because they have not only refused to monetize our channel, but they've also demonetized the Daily channel, which was like, okay, what was that for? No particular reason other than they hate us, so come and help us out, because otherwise you can't keep the light on. And you can always help us out by going and getting Islander Issue 3. So this has been up for a week, and we've already sold half of the stock, so that's fantastic. Basically, get it while you can.
Thank you to everybody who's bought a copy already.
And thank you if you've already got it. The copies are already arriving, which is really great, because I was really worried we'd have another kerfuffle with the delivery times, but no, people are already getting them, so everything is going great. Go and check that out. So, Rishi Sunak, back in 2023, said he's hugely proud of his Indian roots and his connections to India. He says, as you know, my wife is Indian, and being a proud Hindu means that I will always have a connection to India and the people of India. One of the things I did after becoming Prime Minister was to hold a reception for Dilwali in 10 Downing Street. Having the opportunity to welcome many British Indians to number 10, seeing the building decorated from top to bottom in lights and flowers, incredibly proud and emotional moment for me. Because my story is the story of so many people in Britain with deep and enduring links to India, the strength of our country lies in its diversity, and something I've seen many times firsthand since becoming Prime Minister. Okay, that's great. British Indians then were like, oh, well, Rishi Sunak is giving us hope.
Mm.
Rishi Sunak, the first person of colour of Indian origin, has become the Prime Minister of Great Britain back in 2022. This historic milestone is the reason for celebration. Can we not have a moment to appreciate how progressive this is for Britain? To celebrate how far the world has moved from colonial times to modern-day Britain, to one that is open, inclusive, and towards positive change? And of course, the Indians were like, oh, well, you are both DC. Now, do you know what DC means?
Not besides the place in America, no.
And you explained it to me earlier, so yes. I'm not going to spoil it.
It means basically a son of the soil of India.
Ah, okay.
It means part of the Indians.
So it means Indian.
It means, yeah, it literally means of the country, right? So it means of India. So
where are you going with this? I just don't.
Well, you'll see where I'm going. So this was an India Today anchor called Shivarur who was talking about this. And he said, well, they're both DC. They're both Indians. And this is going to be a very special relationship between Sunak and Modi, which I agree. I'm sure it would be.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah, there's a great amount of interest in the Indian origin. British Prime Minister arriving in India. He says, okay, I agree. That was a big deal for India, which is why the Indians celebrated it for ages. And as they say, it was a Dilwali gift. I agree. Yeah, many Indians are delighted at the prospect of Rishi Sunak becoming the first person of Indian origin to become the British Prime Minister, just as Hindus around the world celebrate Dilwali. And speaking of Dilwali, here is the traditional English celebration of Dilwali outside of number 10 with Rishi and his family celebrating it. That's fine. It's all normal. And so yeah,
to preface a lot of this, not that there's anything wrong with that. I think it's unusual that this man was in charge of Britain for a while.
Well, this is the thing,
but
like,
being Indian in and of itself is okay. There's nothing shameful or wrong with that.
I mean, Narendra Modi congratulated Sunak, and Sunak said, well, thank you for your kind words. The UK and India share so much. Yeah, they both have Indian prime ministers. And Rishi Sunak was, of course, proud to be the first British Asian prime minister, from his own words.
Can I just say, I just want to be on the record.
One last thing.
Go on.
And he said that, you know, his story represents the hope and dreams of the Indian diaspora. So his is a story, an example to other Indians to follow. So go on.
Well, I quite like the man. I like the man. I don't, you know, I'm not going to say that he was the best thing ever for Britain. And I think the light touch of his Indian heritage, I think that we're all right. Well, I'm all right with that. I'm all right with this light touch of it. I think British Indians or people who live in Britain of Indian descent often are very much part of the culture without attacking and hating the British culture. So I'm quite okay with him and how he treated his heritage.
And as he said, I'm proud to be the first British Asian PM, and I'm even prouder that it's not a big deal. The thing is, it wasn't a big deal. The big deal about Rishi was that he was put in after Liz Truss was cooed out.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the interesting thing about Rishi Sunak. But like as you say, you know, there's nothing objectionable on a personal level about it. And
I find it very difficult to hate somebody like Rishi Sunak because it feels like bullying, because he's such a like
kick and run character,
meek nerd type. I feel like if I were to be too cruel to the man, I feel like I'd hear reports that he was like going crying into the bathroom crying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I agree. Rishi on a personal level seems like a really nice chap, and there's nothing wrong with him being Indian and celebrating his Indian heritage or anything like that. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. It is weird, though, that now that the conversation has been sparked that, well, of course Rishi Sunak is English, says the New Statesman after Constantine Kissin pointed out correctly, well, you're not English, though, are you, Rishi? And Rishi was like, no, of course I'm English. It's like,
His argument for such being, I own a Labrador.
I like cricket.
Okay.
So let's watch this clip quickly, because he did a little interview talking about this, and I think just pay attention to his body language. Well, we would if that's
born here, brought up here. Of course I'm English. Actually, funnily enough, I think when we were doing that first one of these some time back, you asked about the Tebbit test, and I think you did. It struck me actually, funnily enough, that this debate, it moves well beyond that, because it's not enough just to support England at cricket. It turns out it may not be enough to even play for England in cricket or football. You still can't be English. You look at the composition of our England cricket team, England football team. On
so cricket was not the oldest sport in the world, and we existed as an ethnic group before cricket. How did the English identify themselves as English before cricket?
Well, maybe they couldn't. Yeah. Maybe we just always thought of ourselves as some nebulous concept of just a cluster of cells that just walked upon the earth and occasionally ate some food.
I think that's how Alfred put it when they were defending against the Vikings. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that was in Henry V's speech in France as
well.
It's a bit weird, isn't it? Especially, like, why are you talking about football teams and cricket teams at all? And are they sat in a school classroom? Because those chairs and tables look very small, just as an aside.
That's a good point.
I mean, it would make sense because Rishi himself is a very small man. Again, very bullyable, which is why it would just feel very cruel to do so. The funny thing is, if you go back to that New Statesman article, I actually looked at that the other day for a daily video, that one. If you scroll down far enough, you find the same way that we did with the Politics Joe discussion.
Oh, yeah.
They say, back up again, that paragraph there. If Kissin said that Sunak isn't a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, a WASP, generally American term, he would be on safer ground, at least in a descriptive sense. In fact, this is what is really meant by ethnic English, because it's undeniably true that most doing a lot of heavy lifting there, all, in fact, English people belong in that category and have an ancestral lineage on these isles that goes back centuries. Okay, so as always, they give up the point, which is if you're English, you descend from the Anglo-Saxons.
Yes.
And you could be considered an Anglo-Saxon still. Yes. That's all the point that I'm making. There doesn't need to be a value judgment in any of this. Yeah. And there is, as again, Stelios pointed out, there is a legal and cultural argument that you could make of it as well, because, you know, he doesn't have to say that he's ethnically English, but Rishi could be referring to the fact that he has been raised in the culture of England surrounding him and therefore identifies with that and feels at home when he's here. That's all a fair argument, but if you're talking purely about the identity, it's down to ancestry, heritage.
Yeah, you inherit your ethnicity.
You know, if I was born in India and raised within that culture, you could say, and you know, stuck to that culture and believed in their religions, I could say perhaps I'm, they would call me an Orientalist these days, but I could be called perhaps culturally Indian. But there's no way that they would say that I'm like descended from the same people as them, because I'm not.
No.
And they would recognize that, which is why when it came to decolonization in India, there was no question about who was getting kicked out.
No. Well, can you be racist then against someone who is black but is English? Like, does racism actually ever anymore exist if race doesn't really exist?
Well, Carl,
exist,
you're a black Englishman.
I am.
Can you experience racism?
I can, but we'll save that for segment two.
I know people that lived in China. They're second or third generation living in China. Their parents are from Argentina and America. They aren't Chinese.
Okay.
They're not called. Okay. Chinese are not having it, not even for one millisecond.
Well, no way.
There was an interesting video that I saw pop up on YouTube a few months ago. It was an Englishman who was born and raised in Japan by English parents, who knew the language very fluently, spoke it all the time. He said culturally that he was Japanese, but he was like, well, of course, I'm still English. I'm an Englishman in Japan who's been raised in this culture. He was very respectful of it. Obviously, he had friends there. They all accepted him. He had assimilated, but there was no like harsh judgment from him saying, well, I'm an Englishman in Japan.
No.
I don't see why there needs to be kind of negative value judgment attached to such a statement.
Yeah, and it's only people like Fraser Nelson who are taking objection to this, really, because any right-thinking normal human being, obviously that category excludes Fraser Nelson, would just say, well, he's an Indian man, obviously, which is why India recognizes him as such, but he was born and raised in England, and so he's culturally very English, as Harry's pointing out. There's nothing wrong with this. This isn't an objectionable thing.
Well, what's Nelson's angle then? Why does he need to push this? Just to be a contrarian?
No, he's an extreme liberal.
I think he's an extreme ideologue.
Yes, he's an extreme liberal ideologue. And so his issue is that if we have a particular ethnic identity that is an indigenous one that is exclusive to people on essentially what he would say bioessentialist grounds, then that means that people like Rishi Sunak and, of course, here Sadiq Khan have a less claim to England as a concept than we do, which I think is true.
So who decides whether or not Rishi Sunak is English? Rishi Sunak or everybody else?
I think nature has decided.
I think reality. No,
but like from Fraser Nelson's kind of logical conclusion point of view,
it must be self-identification.
Self-identification.
There we go. Yeah, exactly. This is where we arrive at the trans English position.
I think furthermore on Fraser Nelson, because he is, as stated, a liberal ideologue, the idea of borders, which he's not a huge fan of, and distinctions between peoples in the first place, prevents people from being considered just the mass indistinguishable man that can be used solely for gaining GDP points. The line can't go, if something is in the way of the line going up, and we know that Fraser loves his lines going up because he was bragging about how England was the only country within Europe to have a increasing working age population, but working age population, then that was absolute gangbusters for him. He was over the moon about such a thing.
He is. And so I think when you find yourself on the same side as Sadiq Khan in any argument, then maybe you aren't conservative and maybe you shouldn't be writing for a conservative newspaper or anything like that. So the fact that he can say well put by Sadiq Khan on anything is just remarkable. But let's quickly, this is a remarkable thing anyway. Sadiq Khan, again, I don't really have to go to any length to explain how Sadiq Khan has stressed that he is a Pakistani Muslim man. Because that's something he says.
Yeah, but he hides it. He doesn't ever like.
So. When does he ever bring it up? He doesn't rely on their votes or anything.
Yeah, no, he doesn't. He's an upstanding man.
Yeah, but this is Sadiq Khan's position.
He is our country's first Hindu prime minister. He is somebody who I think, in years to come, will continue to be a role model for young people from all backgrounds. If you close your eyes and listen to Sunak, he's like Jeeves and Worcester. I mean, he's quintessentially English. This
vocal
guy,
cords made a tweed.
I mean, this guy went to Oxford. He was a banker, for goodness sake, and became a member of parliament for the Conservative Party in William Hague's former seat. What else does Sunak have to do to prove his Englishness?
Be born to an English parent, at least one, you know.
He was a banker. That's an ethnic slur, actually. He's playing into perfidious Albion right there. How dare you, Sadiq?
He eats a roast dinner. He wants a roast dinner.
If you close your eyes and he's speaking in an English accent, he's English.
Harry, by this standard, you're not English. You never went to Oxford. You're not a banker.
No, well, my mum worked at a bank once.
Oh, really?
So maybe...
What, with Rachel Reeves?
No, not with Rachel Reeves, although she is about as qualified as Rachel Reeves.
Yeah, so, like, this bizarre sort of, well, if I wear the costume of being English, then surely I am English. And in some senses, that's okay, and it can be respectful, it can be a show of appreciation. You know, imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. But in other ways, it can also be subversive. And it can also be a way of taking something away from you, as I'm sure you're aware with the issues you regularly talk about.
And it does feel the same, doesn't it?
Yeah, and so with Rishi Sunak, I don't feel that Rishi Sunak hates England and the English.
No.
I actually think he probably quite likes it. And for him, this probably was like, oh, I got the Prime Minister of Britain. This is actually really nice. For someone like Sadiq Khan, though, can't help but feel that he does hate England and the English, and he is being deliberately subversive. So don't approve it, especially as, I mean, you'd think that the Sadiq Khan would be slightly more reticent to be like, hey, guys, I made the Asian power list or whatever this is, you know. And it's like...
Did he post that yesterday?
He's the top of the Asian power list. And it's like, why would they put an Englishman at the top of the Asian power list, Sadiq?
Yeah, well, cultural appropriation, isn't it?
I would say.
Just taking that away from a poor South Asian person, that Englishman.
Exactly. How could that be? And so, obviously, we are shown the complete fiction of this, and Ed Dutton summarised it quite nicely. Sadiq Khan claiming his English is little different from India Willoughby, fan of yours, claiming he's a woman, except India at least tries to appear and behave like a stereotypical woman. So,
I don't know what stereotypical woman that is, but he does wear the costume every day.
There we go, right? So there we go. And so, so the question I want to ask then is, why are they doing this? Because nobody really thinks these people are English. They think of them as Indian and Pakistani. What is the push for this?
Well, because if we don't have a collective where we recognise each other as a community, the English, then we don't stand to fight for attacks on us because we don't exist. And so we don't have any loyalty. I think Tucker Carlson talked to people in Australia and said, if you raise your population to hate you, they won't defend you because they won't feel they're part of anything to defend. And I think when we look at how the English came out against the murders in Southport, and how those English sort of rallied around as a community and wanting to protect their own. They're basically now being
far right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they went to jail quick.
This contrasts with something I covered yesterday when I was talking about the pro-Palestine and Israel marches and sorts of things that go on in UK cities recently, which was some actor who'd been in The Crown who had a very British name to him, had attended some pro-Palestine rally and had been picked up by the police and taken in for a statement regarding it. And all of a sudden, when it's his group and his issue, he comes out saying, the right to protest is being taken away from us in this country. Radio silence last August, when people were being picked up off the streets while they were going to attend peaceful protests that were then mischaracterized as riots by the media. Mm. Because that wasn't his group, that wasn't his issue. These people, like Sadiq, for instance, Rishi, I'm less inclined to put like malicious intent on.
I don't think he's malicious.
I think he's a bit hapless. If anything, he does look like, if you've watched the recent Wallace and Gromits where they've started to put a bit more diversity in there, he does come across like a Wallace and Gromit character.
He does look just like one.
Yeah.
A cartoon rodent or something.
You know that he was the least, did he go to Eton or Winchester or Windsor or some, one of them?
Oxford, I think it was.
You know that he was just, do you remember Spitting Image? And there was the, is it David Owen or David Steele? David Steele. One of them was in a pocket. Are you old enough to remember that?
I was very young.
I was about 25. No, I wasn't. He was. But there's like a little sort of big-eared, little tiny politician in a pocket, and Rishi reminds me of that. Of just like,
I mean,
he'll just say
size.
Whatever he should. You know, he'll just say whatever he should in a tiny voice to make sure that nobody hates him, and he can just quietly retire.
We're in America. I think that's his plan. With Sadiq Khan, I do think it is much more malicious with this sort of thing, because if you look at this whole thing from a group dynamic perspective, looking for resource acquisition.
Sadiq has done everything he can to advance his group in this.
Yeah, his group. And what's the easiest way to prevent the other group from defending themselves? Well, just convince them that they're not really a group and that anybody can be part of your group. So it doesn't matter. If you don't exist, you can't defend yourselves.
I think you're basically both on the right point here, because I think that they can feel that something is changing, because I think that for the last at least 25 years, we've seen a lot of group advocacy at the expense of the English in England.
The Muslim Council of Great Britain. And why is it here?
Why does such a thing exist? And it's got to the point now where after the Boris wave of immigration, it's undeniable that something is going wrong with the country on a demographic level.
It's coming.
And I think that people like these, and the reason that an ex-prime minister is talking about it, the mayor of London is talking about it, and what this has come from is basically Twitter anons, I think. People on Twitter being like, what the hell is this? I think this conversation been pushed up, and I think they're sensitive to it, because I think that they are aware that the English are starting to gain a kind of self-consciousness of their own, saying, well, hang on a second. Everyone else understands themselves to be part of these groups. Why don't we have a group? Why have we been introduced?
Well, you've also gotten to be an oppressed group often to really kind of group. To really form a nice, juicy collective, you've got to be oppressed. And I would say that the apathy of the English means that we haven't really noticed. And it's just happening to the scummy people in that scummy place. And it's nothing to do with us. We would never behave
so
badly.
We'll talk about that kind of attitude in my segment.
Oh, good. Well, I'll postpone. But what I do think is with the group dynamics and being English, if you're part of a sort of an elite where you can be a global player, then you don't really have to worry about being English or not. You can say it for some sort of fashion statement, and you can say it because you've got some money tied up somewhere in some land. But for most people, it's neither here nor there. But it's the working class, I think, that need their collective and their communities, because they're being totally decimated and told that they're racist at the same time if they say, well, I just don't want our girls to be murdered or stared at or stabbed or, I just want them left alone. Then clearly you're a racist.
Yeah, and again, this is something within the group dynamics that, like, group evolutionary psychologists have pointed out, that even if you have no sort of consciousness of yourself, all of a sudden, if an opposing group that identifies you as a member of an opposing group comes about, it's very, very natural for people to suddenly get their defenses up and begin to recognize and categorize themselves in that way. Because, as you've mentioned, we've never really had to do that in this country before, up until the past few decades, and it's only just beginning to emerge outside of the lower and working class areas.
And I genuinely think they can feel this coming on the horizon, and they don't want to be left on the outside of it. I think they're thinking, right, so if a kind of English consciousness rises in England, where does that place Sadiq Khan? That places Sadiq Khan in an oppositional position.
He's so awful.
He is.
He really is one of the most loathsome people that ever is on our screen.
He's always adopted an oppositional position on the understanding that the mass majority native population, England's still 75% English.
Well, according to the last census, which is now wildly out of date.
Because there's been like a few million births.
Yeah, they have.
The Boris wave since then, yeah.
Yeah, but they are worried that, this was never the case before, and it's looking like it might be the case in future. And so I think what they're trying to do is essentially prevent us from being able to delineate between us and them.
Do you think there's also an element, because I often feel that it's being done so much and rubbed in your face, like there's so much that's happening to people that you're told, oh, look at this violence over here. Oh, it's not violence, you can't really see it, and if you see it, you're a racist. It's so overt now that I do feel it's meant to provoke people into anger, because if you take everything away, they've got nothing to lose. And if you give someone nothing to lose, then you have no idea what they will do. And I just keep feeling like we're being provoked into some sort of situation where then they can stop us being able to speak online, or they can stop us being able to protest. And all of these things are, I feel like they're done on purpose, and they're strategic, and they know what they're doing.
I think so. I think there's that's an element to it, as well as a kind of... What one thing to remember is that these groups view themselves in contradistinction to us, with a history with us. And so while we think, okay, I'm just a person who lives in 21st century Britain, and I'm just a random person floating around, well, that might be your conception of yourself, but Rishi Sunak and the Indians were like, oh, wow, we've got an Indian Prime Minister of Britain. And there were headlines in India of, like, you know, India has conquered Britain. This is revenge for the empire and things like this.
Pops, where they were going around saying, finally, we're getting payback.
Exactly, right? So you
Why
might...
Why was he that bad?
Well, he didn't do a great job, did he? Let's be honest. But you know, we might have this very neutral, time-independent, liberal view of ourselves, but other people don't have this. Mm. And so that's just something to be aware of. Anyway, the Habsification says, welcome, citizens of Ucadia. We are just as native Ucadians as you. We are all Ucadians now. And that's kind of what it is. Anyway, so let's move on from the trans English to the fact that the British state appears to just have the one state religion now, and that state religion appears to be Islam. And I didn't ever vote for this. Yeah. I didn't sign up for that. Wasn't
certainly part of a manifesto that I ever read.
Yeah, and it's not very English if we're talking about that, Mr. Khan. But before we do, go and get Islander issue 3. It's out now. We've been demonetized again on YouTube, so, you know, thanks very much, YouTube.
It's wonderful.
Come and sign up. Come and support us. Go and buy it. It's a really good magazine, so you will like it. Beautifully modelled there. Right, so let's go back to our favourite Mayor of London.
Done with him today.
No, we're never going to be done with Sadiq Khan, because he's going to be the Mayor of London until time itself stops functioning. London was the first city in the Western world to host Ramadan lights display. It's a powerful symbol of who we are as Londoners. Well, I would have thought that Ramadan lights would have been a powerful symbol of Muslims, which, again, fine, as you'd expect. Of course, Muslims celebrate Ramadan, so that's fine.
A whole month,
but that's hardly diverse and inclusive. No. It's actually really exclusionary. So what Sadiq Khan is kind of unconsciously saying here is that to be a Londoner, you kind of have to be a Muslim, at least in some way. So, interesting. Okay, that's from a proud Englishman.
I just note as well, the holy month of Ramadan. So any of the other religious festivals that I've read, number one, I don't think he mentions Jesus ever. Number two, the word holy doesn't appear with the word Christian or the word Diwali or any of them. Only holy month of Ramadan, which really, really annoyed me.
Anyway, Keir Starmer then came out and was like, yes, of course. And let's watch this, because, I mean, this is just the most, like, glazing doesn't do it justice.
You see Muslims making a difference, helping to deliver every single one of the government's missions. In business, helping to grow our economy. In education, giving our young people the opportunities that they deserve. In our NHS, of course. In charity work. British Muslims are amongst the most generous group in the United Kingdom and beyond. So I must say thank you to you for all of that, and particularly what I know has been a very difficult time for Muslims here in the United Kingdom. With the pain of the conflict in Gaza and the suffering of the Palestinians, I've been profoundly moved by the images of thousands of Palestinians returning to their communities.
I mean...
What else could be said? I mean, yeah, they're making a difference in this country, aren't they?
Well, not...
Is it a good difference?
Not a GDP difference.
Well, no. The crime statistics.
But the working age people.
Yeah.
Loads. Dependents, plenty of them.
But, like, the idea that he's essentially saying, look...
Sanguinous marriage. That's
up. We'll get to that. Britain would collapse if it wasn't for Muslims, essentially.
It's a lovely, isn't it? A nice thing to be like. If I forget how much I really do loathe the political movement, the globalist political movement of Islam, and just say like, it's great that a prime minister would say to anybody of any faith, "Oh, happy whatever your festival is." That's great, sure. But to sort of say Muslims have done this, Muslims—it's a very bizarre thing to do anyway, because it's not statistically necessarily true. And it will always then say, Muslims are doing this. And the message really is, others not so much.
Yes.
Or I'm not talking about others. I'm just talking about this one group of people. And it's really divisive.
Well, on St. George's Day, does he come out and praise the English? On, like, you know, Dilwali, does he come out and praise the Hindus?
Well, he might praise Sadiq.
Maybe.
On St. George's Day. So maybe he does praise the English after all.
But, But yeah, this was really weird, kind of uncalled for, and looked. I mean, it's strange that you get into the realm of worship.
Right? It's just very like, what is the point? Who told you to do this? And it reminds me of Angela Rayner doing the, I'm very pleased to be with these constituents, and she's in a group of all Muslim men in a room. It's as a
being
woman
held hostage. Yes.
Yeah, but as a woman, I honestly, it's really frightening. It should frighten us all. But as a female, looking at how the women in Iran and Afghanistan were looking in the 70s and 80s and how they look right now, I think if you're not frightened of this creep, this Islamic creep, then you're not paying attention.
Yeah, I mean, it's genuinely... what he said as well was, you know, you're helping deliver the government's targets or missions. And it's like, right, so are you saying that the Muslim community in Britain is a client group of the government that is somehow advancing the government's agenda? I mean, that's
yes, that is, yeah.
Exactly, seems to be word for word what he's saying.
Well, I mean,
right?
Prior to being put in as prime minister, he had that meeting with Sadiq Khan where he explicitly said we need to do more to tackle Islamophobia.
Wow.
And he was going to bring in his prosecutorial experience.
Without saying anything about what it was. So let's say he was there'd been this spate of attacks, right? Which we know there haven't been. There have been criticisms.
Well, they use organisations like Tell Mama to judge such things, and they are an explicit like ethno-religious interest group who try to blow up all these statistics to make it look as bad as possible, whereas really it's just people calling to Tell Mama going, I felt threatened today.
It's really the blasphemy is coming back, isn't it? But I mean, it's already back with hate speech, so yeah.
Anyway, so you were saying about the consanguineous marriages. Robert Jemrick and the Conservatives have been trying to put a bill through to ban cousin marriage, which, again, nobody in England should have an objection to.
But it's strange that we have to do it in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though I'd say disgusting. So I would sort of, I talk about it being gross and disgusting because I know my cousins.
Yeah,
and weirdly, they were always out of the dating pool. And And I feel it's also...
So you're not from Cornwall.
It's not very tolerant of you, is it, Posey?
But it's really... You used to be able to say... Well, you can say, I still do say. You know, I would say Pakistani Muslim... I don't know if you can say that word without getting cancelled on your channel.
I'm going to say it in the next segment, so don't worry about it.
You can say the word R-A-P-E, can you?
Yeah, I mean...
Okay, so Pakistani Muslim rape gangs. Yeah. You have to kind of say Asian... You were supposed to say Asian grooming gangs, and then actually it's not all Asians. And then with this sort of grossness of incest... Like, I'd say it was incest.
It is. And
it produces...
Yeah. Only scientifically, yeah.
I mean, yeah. And so you're not allowed to... Someone, a group of Muslim men, I was arguing with them about it the other day, and they were saying, oh, it's not gross. I was like, oh, it's literally not gross. Is. It literally
I get to decide
is.
What I think is gross. Mm-hmm. Like, anyway,
sorry.
You know who doesn't think it's gross?
Who?
Sadiq Khan?
Keir Starmer, of course. Right, because you know the Conservatives are like, look, maybe we don't.
Starmer just there, like, well, I mean, who didn't have a crush on their sexy cousin right. when they were younger?
Oh, it's no, but so hideous, isn't it?
That's not what he's doing. He's saying, know, no, look, we have to protect the Muslim community. We're a multicultural society. And this is part of their culture. Therefore, you being a racist and trying to stop that would be tantamount to essentially hate speech or something.
Listen. Those birth defects, they're great for GDP. All
yeah,
right?
Something racist.
Yeah. The NHS would be nowhere without birth defects.
Yeah, and so what we can see is the government and the instruments of government are essentially a Muslim advancement scheme that rely on the Muslims to do their agenda and are intent on making the Muslims front and center. So basically what they're saying is this is an Islamic state. Right? This is for Muslims. Yeah. What they're saying.
It's like the halal slaughter and loads of halal meat is now on school menus and it's on my kid's school menu, which I wouldn't let them have actually because I totally fundamentally disagree with anything. I don't care whether animal slaughter is humane or not. We can have that argument that it probably isn't. But we made our laws and rules and we made a decision in this country what was okay and how we should slaughter animals. Why then either Jewish or Muslim should be able to come in and say, well, we do it like this. Well, okay, then don't eat meat. Like, just don't do it.
Order it from overseas.
But it's very bizarre that we do this all the time as English, identifiably English people. We do it all the time going... What's the harm? Yeah, let's just do it. Let's just let them. And then the next minute, you can't go somewhere and actually get meat that isn't halal.
Yeah. So anyway, on that note, no, you're absolutely right.
I think the most recent one that I've seen was that in Manchester, the Five Guys there has now switched to a fully halal menu.
Well, I mean that's...
So I don't think you can get like a bacon cheeseburger there anymore.
That's just responding
What's
to market
demand.
What's the
point of a Five Guys burger if you can't get bacon on it?
Five Pillars, it's now called.
Yeah.
You know what? We'll get to that. So you might think, okay, so the government's screwed, the state is generally against us, so we could at least go to the church for some Christianity, and good luck with that because this is what they posted on their social media feed on Shrove Tuesday. Now,
wait, they're talking net zero?
Yeah, net zero.
Net zero.
No post about Shrove
that
Tuesday.
That is a religion, right?
Yes. Yes, it is. And the real religion is in the revealed behaviours of what a person does. You know, if you go to the mosque every day and you pray five times a day, you can really say, now that person is a true Muslim. If you're constantly posting about net zero and you've got nothing to say on Shrove Tuesday about Jesus Christ, maybe, then... You can probably say that the Church of England's real religion isn't Christianity. And it wasn't until the next day, they were like, oh yeah, good point. There's something going on, isn't there? Isn't it like, yeah, that's right, Ash Wednesday, Lent, something like that. Oh God, get the Bible quick. You know, like...
What's in here?
Yeah, exactly.
I've forgotten.
Has anyone read this? So the Church of England, not much use when it comes to defending the traditional faith.
I just say to all people, if your children go to a Church of England school, do have a look at their trans inclusion policies because you will find they teach that nonsense.
Yeah, their religion is woke. It's not Christian.
Catholic schools as well. There's a Catholic school near my house that has an enormous, like, you can see it from the street, this enormous mural dedicated to equity, diversity and inclusion on the wall. And aren't you supposed to be just teaching, like, about Catholicism and other things that schools are supposed to be teaching, like maths and English?
Yeah, and so you might be like, okay, well, Can we go above the Prime Minister? Can we go above the church?
Well, the Queen's dead, so...
Yeah, who's in charge of Britain on a technical level? It's King Charles, right? In the United Kingdom, he is the head of the Church of England. So you would think that King Charles, defender of the faith, might want to step in and say, excuse me, Church of England, we're a Protestant Christian country. Mm. Would you like to do something about that? But... he's never really been a big fan of Protestant Christianity.
God,
he does have a few things to say about Islam, though. He's been saying these, as you can see, this is quite a young, you know, well, quite young, quote-unquote, from Charles from a few years ago. It's been going around, and...
The rights of Muslim women to property and inheritance and to the conducting of business were rights prescribed by the Quran 1,400 years ago. Some of these rights were novel even to my grandmother's generation. Think what could be achieved if mothers and fathers, the teachers and madrasas and imams, all sought to demonstrate to children how to translate Islamic teachings into practical action. Many of the traits on which modern Europe prides itself came to it from Muslim Spain. Diplomacy, free trade, open borders, the techniques of academic research, of anthropology, etiquette, fashion, various types of medicine, hospitals.
That's a contradiction, isn't it?
Islam is part of our past.
This isn't that incredible? Like, basically, every virtue that Europe has comes from Islam.
Can I just say there
according to Charles, wait, so can Charles, I just... is it Judeo-Christian values or Spanish Islamic values that made Europe great?
Well, you know, when they slaughtered the Spanish, it was that.
Yeah.
Can I just... I just want to offer one defence of this and how this is put together.
Yeah.
Could this not be part of a longer speech that was basically reminding Muslims that the recession of women's rights, which operates so successfully in Muslim countries, is not actually part... it is part of the teachings of the Quran. I think we all know that because I've read the Quran. But you could argue that they made it so far all those years ago to be so regressive now is nonsensical. Could that not be argued that, aside from the open borders bit, maybe he was saying something quite... instructive?
I mean, he probably is, and that probably is the case. But to say that everything good about Europe, like... diplomacy, free trade.
Come on, Muhammad was diplomatic. It was like,
very diplomatic.
Convert or die.
I mean, outside of any...
war is politics by other means, says Muhammad.
Yeah.
Outside of even any Christian values that you would want to attribute to Europe, I would just say what made Europe great and gave us all our values was just the people, first and foremost, the European people.
No, it was the Muslims in Spain.
But anyone's European, so...
Yeah, exactly. Open borders. Gave us open borders.
Open borders. Yeah. That's such a bizarre thing to say.
Well, especially when you think about how the Muslims came to be in Spain. It was an invasion.
Yeah,
they sent 80,000 men over and conquered the Visigothic kingdom in Spain. So, you know,
they tried to get
open borders.
They tried to get into northern France, and we had to beat them back.
Yeah,
you're all proper blokes here, aren't you? So you're all massively into your
military history. I mean, I know all about the guy who stopped Islam from going further into.
I mean, come on, the Crusades are kind of awesome.
Aren't we looking back on the Crusades now with more of a like a
Well, they were kind of.
Were they great? I agree. I think there's this idea that they were terrible, but they were necessary.
Trying to convince people, like European people, that the Crusades were some kind of evil incursion into peaceful Islamic territory. It's just been another avenue of attack for people when we were defending ourselves. I mean, again, the fact that Spain was almost entirely Muslim, except for a tiny little mountain range at the very far north of it, should say it all.
I mean, I recently went to Rio and I was talking to a Brazilian woman just on the English thing, just harking back to the English thing. And everyone in Brazil is Brazilian. And there's you don't even look back. So her parents are from Lebanon. And so she would say that, you know, nobody would say you Lebanese Brazilian. You're just all Brazilian. And I was like, yeah, because you're all from somewhere else. So therefore your unification is the fact that you're from somewhere else and you live in this country. But that isn't the same as in England. Like, I would, and this is before this, I happened to have the same discussion with her about being English.
Well, I was making this point because it's a very much a new world, old world split. Because in the old world, countries and landmasses are named after tribes. Whereas in the new world, the people name themselves after the landmass. So Americans are not Americans because America was named after a tribe called the Americans. They called themselves Americans when they got there because the landmass had already been named. But England is called England because of the Anglo-Saxons.
Mm.
And so it's a complete inversion of what's happening. It's the further Americanization of Europe, basically. But anyway, so King Charles, you might say, well, this was a few years ago. Maybe he's changed his mind. Mm. Well, no, obviously not. here, you know, he's packing dates for the iftar celebrations.
Yeah, but with sausages.
With his sausage fingers. Really so fast.
Countries collapsing around him here is what he's doing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like when this is in the history books, like, right, so there were Islamic rape gangs running around and what was King Charles doing? Well, he's packing dates for iftar, obviously. Why wouldn't he be? Like, embarrassing. But anyway, so they...
It's a bit silly, isn't he? It's a bit silly.
It's embarrassing. I hate him. So they had the iftar in Windsor Castle. And, I mean, I've got friends who are, like, in other countries who are just like, wow, this is the sort of thing that you normally do to people when they've been conquered. It's like, huh, that's a good point. Massively disrespectful, at the very least.
Not a carol, is it?
Horrible, awful wailing, yeah. I would describe it.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of it, and it should never have been permitted.
I like screaming heavy metal, and I'm like, no, that's not for me.
And again, there's a sort of another Americanism where it's like, oh, don't we have a separation of church and state? It's like, no, the head of state is literally the head of the church. We are not an American republic, right? And so why are Muslims being allowed to go into Windsor Castle? Why are they? And the only answer I can give is that, well... I mean, our state religion appears to be Islam. I mean, look, it's Keir Starmer at the thing. Just loving it. He's thrilled. This is the best thing he's done ever.
I do think for people watching, though, who object, and I include myself in this, if you don't want this to happen to this country, then you probably do have to start going to church. I mean, I'm a full-on atheist, but I do feel like you might, in order to be culturally... protecting what it means to be English and what the values are of what we might consider the values of this country, and you don't like the creep of Islam, then you are going to have to go and put your backside on a pew on a Sunday.
Have you done that?
I did go before Christmas.
So did I, actually. Mm. I went Christmas Eve, and I kind of hated it because it was a kind of modern church where it's like they. I was thinking, okay, I wouldn't mind going to church if it was some guy who's, you know, slam the Bible down and go, right, you're all sinners for this reason. And then we're going to have, like, you know, proper old sort of gothic hymns or something, you know, so it's like, it feels intense. But no,
you want the Peter Hitchens church.
Yeah, no, I do. I want something that feels, you know, like, you know, Gregory the Great would have approved, you know what I mean? Like something quite intense. But no, instead what we got is like a pop song that had like Jesus lyrics over the top of it. And I was just sat there going, right, I hate this. You know, it kind of made me want to take over the church and start just reading.
You've got school-age kids, though. So yeah, do you go to the... Do they do a nativity still?
Yeah, they do still do the nativity.
Yeah, that made me feel Christmassy. Two Christmases ago, I went to the church and there was like a little Mary and a little lamb got lost and there was a Joseph and we sang terrible hymns, actually. And then this year, it was more like a PowerPoint presentation of the many names of Jesus. And what was really funny as well, he's like, if you haven't brought cash with you to donate, like when they pass in there, there's a QR code that you can just very. But yes, I think go to church, go and shape, go and like protect what you want to protect and be part of that.
That's
really
true. I agree. And so, I mean, Islam might be the state religion, but it's not like Muslims are going to get special privileges under the law.
No.
Turns out they are, actually. So here are the pre-sentence report guidelines. So this is advice that is given by, what's the name of the thing? They've got a particular name of the institution that's...
CPS?
Not the CPS. It is... I can't remember the name of it. But there's an institution that was set up by the Conservatives in 2010. I've got it written down here somewhere.
Woke, idiot. Kind of guidance? No?
Yeah, it is basically that. But this was set up in 2010 by the Conservative Party. The Sentencing Council is what it is. Sorry, there we go. So the Sentencing Council was set up in 2010 by the Tories and Lib Dems to give advice to the judiciary about how their sentencing should be carried out and what would be fair, right? And so they give these guidelines out. Now, the guidelines aren't themselves law, but they are heavily taken into consideration. This is essentially the government's instruction on how they want things to be. And as you can see, when we get down to the pre-sentence reports, so they do these pre-sentence reports before forming an opinion of the sentence, and these are legally required in certain situations. So They say, normally considered. So they say the pre-sentence report would normally be considered necessary if the offender belongs to one or more of the following cohorts. So we're very clearly looking at a two-tier system here, right? So if they're at risk of first custodial sentence or risk of one for 2 years or less, if they're a young adult, so 18 to 25 years, right? If they're female, right? Or if they're from an ethnic minority, cultural minority, and or faith minority community. So what we have here is if you combine these two, the young adult and ethnic minority, what you have here is special privileges for young Muslim men that are not given to young English men because they are not part of an ethnic minority or a faith minority.
Unless those English men are black.
Well.
Who are these English men?
Yep. But
also female. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Let me get more lenient sentences.
But why?
That's a great question. I would say it's a general sort of patriarchal holdover from previous eras, where women have always been given lighter sentences than men.
But I get it if a woman is coerced, because there can be if you could prove that in a mitigating thing that actually a woman was completely coerced, lived in a terrible, abusive relationship, but then also you'd be able to do that if it was the other way around.
Of course, yeah.
I don't really like that.
No, I don't.
Actually,
really.
Even as a woman, I don't like pregnant, postnatal, 100%, because that is for the sake of a baby and you are in a different.
Yep.
But no. Okay. Sorry. You carry on.
No, that's fine. Because I do agree with you that essentially what we have here is a stratified form of justice. And of course, straight white men who are 25 or older. So we could call them taxpayers. Because they are the majority by far of taxpayers, and the only net tax-paying demographic in the country are now at the bottom of the hierarchy when it comes to consideration under the law. So you will get a longer sentence if you are a tax-paying English man than any other demographic.
That's nice.
Yeah. It's just preposterous. But
what do you pay your taxes for so you can go to prison? So
yeah, yeah. Well, to promote Islam, actually.
Well, we don't want productive people in this country, do we?
Well, no, absolutely. And so,
women aren't productive.
Luckily, the Labour, what was the exact title? I want to get right, just so I've got it right. There we go. Lord Chancellor and Secretary of State for Justice, Shabana Mahmood, has reassured us that don't worry, we don't listen to the sentencing council. Oh.
So they're getting paid for no reason.
Yeah, so why are they there?
They're getting paid to twiddle their thumbs and come up with rules that no one will listen to anyway, but we won't disband them.
Exactly. She says the sentencing council is entirely independent. Okay, how do they make their money? They make their money.
How do they?
From the government, obviously. Like, they don't have, private
initiative.
What's
the point of any of these things? There's loads of these. I'll digress very quickly, but there's the national police chiefs. They sort of have a body, but they don't really govern. They don't really do. I don't understand what the point of any of them are.
Mm-hmm.
It's either law or it's not.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care what you recommend and what you like to eat for breakfast on a Sunday. Like,
it's a long conversation that we don't have time for.
Sorry,
now, I'm afraid.
Shut up.
No, it's fine. Don't worry. I did invite you on to talk. So we don't have time to go through that. But she says, well, today's updated guidelines do not represent my views or the views of the government. I'll be writing to the Sentencing Council to register my displeasure and to recommend reversing this change to guidance. As someone who is from an ethnic minority background myself, I do not stand for any kind of differential treatment before the law. Well, I guess I'll take her word for it.
So she's going to register her displeasure and recommend. She's going to recommend guidance to the people that offer the guidance so that the people that follow the guidance might not follow the guidance and be recommended by her if she doesn't recommend it.
That's exactly yeah. What's happened.
Okay, good.
And, we're going to just pretend that the judges have been completely neutral and haven't been showing favouritism to ethnic minorities for decades now.
Rape a kid? Couple of weeks. Talked about someone raping a kid? Couple of years.
It's genuinely what's happened in this country. And the only person I've seen of any substance calling this out has been Robert Jemrick, who said, look, this will enshrine anti-white and anti-Christian bias in the criminal justice system. It's like, yeah, well, it's already there anyway, so you can make it formal. But anyway, that's that.
We've got quite a couple rounds. In particular, we've got $50 from Freddy65. Thank you very much for the very generous donation. Saying thank you to the Lotus Eaters and Kelly J. She's fab. Just woke up and tuned in. Glad someone is speaking the truth.
doing our best, but we're being penalised for it, so, you know.
Yeah, that's really kind of you for $50, though, man.
Ramshackalot says, look into the holy metropolis of Mercia in British Isles, a group of Orthodox monks trying to revive pre-Catholic English Christianity. Mercian monks on YouTube. Okay, that actually sounds cool.
Invoking Mercia is the way to get my attention.
Weakest of the Saxon kingdoms.
Not, well...
That's not true. They were just the last capitulate to the Vikings, says a man of Wessex. Anyway, let's move on.
All right, then. So to round off this trio of horrors, this very jolly podcast that we've been talking about, we're going to talk about the complete institutional failures of the police and the social services to protect young girls from working and lower class backgrounds in the UK. Because outside of even the ethno-religious aspect of the grooming gangs, I think there are other cases that you can point to as well to just show that for a long time the institutions of this country just abandoned these people, abandoned these poor young girls, and left them to the wolves.
They could consider converting to Islam, couldn't they?
They could have.
Then Keir Starmer would be like all over it.
Well, yeah, then perhaps they might get some justice. But the justice is being looked into by the Rochdale grooming gang trial, which is currently ongoing, and I'll look into some of the details regarding that. But I really do think it is not just a failure because of the obvious racism that these police were afraid of being accused of, but because they just didn't seem to care all that much about these girls, and because of that apathy, it allowed room for these predators who wanted to victimize women because of the fact that they were from a different ethnic group to them. Saw an advantage that they took. It allowed for
people,
room for that.
They saw people who fell outside of the grace of the law. Right? Yes. They don't care. The institutions don't care. And when you say women, are these even women?
Well, like, these are girls.
These are girls,
these
right.
Very, very so, young girls. Yeah, so I don't want to mischaracterize that. If you want to read something that's a bit more jolly than all this and might get you to smile and think, then consider buying Islander. We've got Islander 3 out right now. You can get that on the website for the low, low price of $14.99. Was it half of all of the copies we've printed have already been sold? Is that correct? And people have already been receiving them, so we don't seem to have any of the distribution promises.
I'll give you a copy to get away with.
Very nice. It's very beautiful.
It is, isn't it?
Thank you very much.
And that's limited time only, limited copies available, so get one whilst you still can. So to just highlight the fact that this is not purely an issue, although it's very largely an issue of ethno-religious persecution from outside groups, here's an example that I found just going through the Manchester Evening News, because Rochdale's in Manchester, talking about a case that's going through the courts right now of a man called Christopher Oates on trial at Manchester Crown Court, charged with 7 counts, including sexual activity with a child and inciting child prostitution. This is a pretty horrifying headline. A pimp to 2 teenagers who held a gun to a girl's head and said, "You do as I say, you're mine." Now, one of the things that we find out...
Slavery.
Basically, yes. One of the things we find about a lot of these old cases, these cases going through court right now, is that they're quite old. Yeah. So with the Rochdale grooming gang trials that's going right now, it was between, I think, 2001 and 2006 that the events were actually taking place. This one was between 2004 and 2005. Mm. So again, it's just another example of the Greater Manchester Police's complete failure to tackle the problems as they were emerging. We've had plenty of other grooming gangs taken down. Obviously, this is one of the ones that they'll point to and say, see, it's not just Pakistani Muslims raping these girls, because look, we found one Englishman.
Yep. He looks like a good, nice man though, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He doesn't look like a wrong'un.
No, he's just obvious English scum, which nobody has ever claimed has not been involved in these kinds of crimes in the past. Obviously, there's always...
Whatever punishment we give them, give him.
Yes.
You know, obviously.
But that doesn't stop the fact that a large majority of these cases always seem to come back to the same type of perpetrator.
Six decades, can I just say.
For a very, very long time. And, of course, there was a gang report back in January of 2024 that was published that found some key findings. I'll just read through the headlines here. So the girls were left at the mercy of the gangs. The dozens of offenders, probably more than that actually,
it's gonna be
still at large, because oftentimes when you look into the actual way that these communities work, most of the time it's pretty much the entire community keeping each other's backs. Emerging threat of exploitation was not addressed, particularly between 2004 and 2007. Child sex exploitation was a low priority, and under-resourced by the Greater Manchester Police.
How is that a low priority?
It's just a low priority. You've got young girls being raped mostly by foreigners. We don't care. We don't care. We've got other things to tackle.
It's just hard to think of what is more important. I mean, maybe overt terrorism is more important.
Overt terrorism, violent crime.
It is terrorism, though, isn't
but it? It is terrorism. Terrorism. And the statutory agencies, so this will include the child services as well, failed to respond.
And are often riddled with perpetrators. Yes. That's the big thing, isn't it?
Yes.
The councils and the police
have had people go
to jail for this.
I've owned this book for a while, actually, but recently after the discussion that was brought up when Elon Musk started to talk about it, a lot of people recommended that we read this book by Peter McLaughlin, Easy Meat. And this is a study from 2016 that looked into a lot of the reports that have been filed up to that point, because obviously it was only really in the past 10 to 15 years the mainstream media started to really take a look at this.
Just a quick thing as well, it's difficult to get a hold of a copy of this book.
It is. I had to get it through eBay. It's not available for sale through Amazon anymore. I think it might have been at one point. But it's interesting how all the time, every single one of these cases seems to have the same pattern of behavior to it, which has been reported from here. So this goes back to some of the earliest cases that he was able to find. I imagine that they go back much further. Was in 1988 when it was actually Sikh communities. Actually Sikh communities being victimized by Muslim grooming gangs, and the police, instead of actually doing anything about it, chose to target the vigilante groups, the Sikh vigilante groups.
They're the real problem.
Because they were defending their own communities and trying to defend their own daughters. I, of course, imagine that a lot of this goes back, as you say, probably six decades or more. And then it's when you get to 1991 that you start to see these cases pop up, where in Bradford, for instance, they were taking girls from children's homes, prostituting them, then returning them to the children's homes during the day. And again, they all follow the same kind of MO, which is, here you get a boyfriend aged 18 to 25 who showers her with gifts, collects her in his car outside of a school on an almost daily basis. He proceeds to make her dependent on him, perhaps changing her name, but proceeding to destroy her connections with other people. He ends up furthering his control of her, often by humiliation, threats, and fear, oftentimes plying with drugs and alcohol as well, all the while pretending it's a loving relationship. The final stage is he has total control when she becomes a willing victim. She will have sex for him without seeing any of the money herself. So they basically groom these people into being willing rape victims who the authorities then classify as prostitutes and say, well, they're just prostitute slags who have asked for it. They're letting it happen to themselves, which is exactly what is the argument that's going to be put forward and has been put forward already in this trial. So the most recent trial, as mentioned, has had a few twists and turns already. The initial jury had to be discharged back in January, and they were able to get a new jury. They didn't mention why it was that they were discharged, for legal reasons apparently, but who knows what that could mean. If they're getting it from the local community, who knows if there were people in the local community who might have even been involved in the whole thing. The most recent reports are that one of the girls, so the girls who are putting the charges forward, are classified as Girl A and Girl B. For obvious reasons, we do not have their names. The perpetrators who are being charged are Mohammed Zahid, 64, Naheem Akram, 48, Mohammed Shahzad, 44, Nissa Hussein, 41, Rahiz Khan, 39, Arfan Khan, 41, and Mushtaq Ahmed, 67, and Kashir Bashir, 50. And remember, these cases go back about 20 years. Yeah. So some of those, like 39 years old now,
were in their 40s. Yeah.
Well, some of them were in their 40s. Some of them would have been teenagers at the time when these were going on. And she's been, Girl A is the one that this report talks about mainly, which was that she was used as a sex slave when she was a child, and said that she could have been abused by more than 200 men. Now, the number has changed a few times when she's been asked about this, and and the defense is trying to harp on that and say, well, what is it? Is it this number? Is it over 100?
Keep 200? A list. Like, how do I know? You know,
when you're blacked out, drunk, on drugs, and loads of different men are coming in. That's what they did, didn't they? Yep. They just haven't.
I didn't give them receipts. Like, oh, God, that's insufferable.
Yeah, so one of the complainants said that she was targeted in the town by a group of Asian men from the age of 13, with her phone number passed around between them. There was that many, it was hard to keep count. The other complainant, Girl B, was also 13 at the time of the abuse, the alleged abuse. Prosecutors told the jury that the girls supplied with drugs, alcohol and cigarettes before they were expected to have sex with the defendants and others whenever they wanted. So again, the same kind of story again and again. I think with these ones, it's that the oldest man involved in this, Mohammed Zahid, ran a stall at the Manchester markets and would give them lingerie to try to tempt them over and pretend.
And these
like
are girls often from troubled, yes, feeling unloved, unworth, no value.
Oftentimes from very, very bad backgrounds. I think some of these
already
girls
sexually abused.
Already, and a lot of them are already going through the care home system.
Yeah, so they're already on a scrap heap where nobody really gives a damn about them.
Yeah. So giving evidence on Wednesday, Girl A said that she'd been approached by police in 2009 when they were investigating child sexual exploitation, but declined to exist. She was also approached in 2015 again, but she declined, but she changed her mind later on that year. So again, as laid out in books like these, and this is 2016 this book came out, even reports from a Barnardo's report that was done in 2011, which of course didn't mention any of the ethnic or religious aspects of it, to make sure that you didn't actually know who was perpetrating this. But everybody knows that what was done was that these girls were made to feel like it was normal, that this is just what girls do, even if it's seen as somewhat inappropriate. But then you've got the police, outside of these few occasions where years later they're being approached, at the time treating it like it's normal. Oh, you're just a prostitute. The social services treating it like it's normal, so they don't think it's unusual. They don't have any frame of reference. That all that they've known in their entire life has been abuse.
In 1993, I was training to be I never taught, but as part of my theology degree, I also did a teaching degree. And I went to houses in something called Eccles Hill, which is a really poor area. I think it's on the outskirts of Leeds, Bradford kind of area. And we went into someone, so I went round with an EWO, an educational welfare officer, whose job it is to find out why kids aren't in school. And we went into a house and this girl was prepubescent, but she must have been at a high school, which is like age 13 minimum. I always thought she was about 11. And when we came out, she hadn't been to school for about six, seven weeks. And when we came out, he said, well, you know, she's on game. And I was like 19 and naive.
What does that mean?
And I was like, oh, okay. And then I said, oh, what's on game? And he said, well, you know, she's a prostitute. 13.
Was this her dad?
This was an educational welfare officer who'd gone to check on why she hadn't gone to school. And his attitude was so much, and I sort of blanked it out for years, and then it came back to me about 10 years ago. Yeah. But his attitude was like, she's a prostitute, her mum's a prostitute, her sister's a prostitute. She's a prostitute.
So it's fine, just leave it. What's the point in trying?
Not she's a victim of abuse. Not she's being exploited.
She's 11.
Not she's being raped. None of those things. It was just that she was a prostitute. Full stop, end of story. Nothing we can do. That's how we felt.
And that's the same attitude that we see here. So this was one of the children, Girl B, saying that the Rochdale Social Services file that she'd picked up for she'd been picked up for loitering and prostitution. So they'd just put her down, 13 years old, as a prostitute, didn't go any further into it. She rejected suggestions by lawyers for the accused that she was claiming that she was abused to get compensation, because of course they're going to go down that route. Girl B said that when the abuse began, she was living in a children's home, there you go, started to hang around the Rochdale market, where Mohammed Zahid, then in his 40s, owned a stall. Each week she was taken to a shop in Rochdale owned by another man, Mushtaq Ahmed. She said she was repeatedly raped there by them and other people. They would take turns on her. She said that on other occasions, Ahmed would drive her and Zahid to a house in Chadderton near Rochdale. There would be three of them and other men there who spoke a language she did not understand. Mm-hmm. She said that she told the police and the social services what was going on. They said I was a prostitute and I was prostituting myself. I don't remember them being concerned enough to do anything about it. I remember that they're knowing that they knew what was going on. It always happened, so it was nothing new to me. I assumed they knew all. The police had picked me up. It all just seemed to me everybody knew what was going on. So when these people come out years later and say, oh, why didn't you do anything at the time? Why didn't you go to the police? Why are the charges only coming out now? She spoke to the police. She spoke to the social services. She was going through...
They were permissive of it.
She was going through the children's homes.
The people in the children's... So there was a woman... I did a Let Women Speak in Oldham. So we've decided we're going to go to some of these towns so that the victims... So that the words are spoken on the streets. Like, the words you're not allowed to say, like, Pakistani Muslim paedophile rape gangs, I think is how we should tell them, which is what I said very loudly, repeatedly in Oldham. And anyway, one of the women talked, and she'd worked in a children's home. She was a newly qualified social worker. She'd worked in a children's home. And she said these girls would come back like zombies. And everyone knew what was going on. And the liberal, so difficult not to swear, the liberal kind of people that were working there were saying things like, we can't stop them going out. Like, these were in charge of 13, 14-year-old girls. Well, because it's their right.
Screw their rights.
Exactly. Well, that's what I think.
They're children. Children. They need boundaries. They need protection from their own actions. Especially
their own actions. Protection from other people's actions.
And other people's actions. I mean, when you're 13, 14, even if you're being taken advantage of, you can very easily rationalize it in your own mind, especially when you're that young and naive.
Well, you're getting love. You might get a necklace. You might get some vodka. You might get some
technique that they do.
Yeah, I mean, there's men that are very famous for doing that.
Yes.
Who are very much celebrated by potentially some of your audience, but it's really frightening that everybody will be party to it, will know it, will enable these men. They saw the men pick up the girls from the children's home, and I just can't get past not then spending my life trying to stop it. Like, if you know that that's happening, why would anyone not try and do everything they possibly could to try and stop it? And one of the really tragic things about all of it is it's very rare that you're a very reliable witness if you've been a victim of such incredible trauma. Yeah. So you'll either sound like a liar, or maybe you're too well-spoken and too okay. And then did you really suffer that much if you're articulate and you sound educated? You know, but if you're not articulate and educated, then you're obviously just a problem person and you probably brought it on yourself. It's really scary.
And that's not to speak of the sort of institutional bias towards political correctness, where they don't want to deal with this because all they can hear in their own heads is, oh, this is racist.
Yeah.
This is racist. This is, and it's like...
But rather be a rapist than a racist.
100%. And it's just... Oh, that's horrific.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, a person I met a few months ago at a wedding, of all places, I was talking to him and the subject came up and he told me, I forget if it was Rotherham or Rochdale, but he told me he went to school with one of the girls who was being abused like this. And, you know, he was like 12, 13 himself at the time, so he didn't really understand the full implications. But he saw this girl every day at the end of school get picked up by the same people who were Pakistani Muslims, who were not her family or friends or anything. All the teachers saw it, and they must have all known what was going on. Nobody did anything.
Well, in that school that I worked in was called Eccles Hill or Ravenscliff. I can't remember, but it doesn't exist anymore anyway. Mm-hmm. So you had the third generation Pakistani boys and the mixed race boys. They were dealing. So these were like the social issues. They were dealing. The white girls you were worried about being prostitutes and the Pakistani girls you were worried that wouldn't come back to school after the summer because they'd been sent to Pakistan to be married off. I mean, these are... Everybody knew this. This is... You know, it's like you say, it's a lie to say that nobody knew. Everybody knew what was going on. Nobody really cared. And I think when it comes to the police and the social workers, I think often they had either been corrupted from within by people who were also raping those girls, no matter what ethnicity they were. I think maybe they were kickbacks like that. Or there were people from those communities who very much change the conversation so that those victims of crime, those victims of rape couldn't come forward, because then it was like, you know, community leaders, as we've seen, this government especially loves a community leader. And so I think that's been going on for a really long time. And that also goes back to the English thing that we can't defend our daughters because who are they?
Well, this is what the EDL was. The EDL was the attempt to defend the daughters from the rape gangs. And what did the state? The state crushed it. Absolutely crushed it.
And again, it does seem from the fact that some of the stuff that Peter McLaughlin found in this, that they initially started off in what he found as the earliest ones, were the Sikh daughters as well. It does just seem to be that these people identify outgroup and go, we'll go after them. Yeah. And it was upon realizing that, oh my God, we'll be able to just get away with this because the police are going to go after them for defending themselves. We can get away with this as much as we want. Mm. And I mean, what's that, 1988?
Didn't the Sikhs send their daughters away, though? Sorry, I think the Sikhs often work together in their communities, and they sent their daughters away from the home.
They did, but also when it was first emerging, it did end up in street violence as well, because, of course, you find out that this is happening before you've been able to take those measures to send your daughters away. People are going to want to get payback for this when they know the police aren't going to do
it. I would, wouldn't you? I would, I would even if the police did want to do something. Someone touched my daughter.
It's completely natural, absolutely. Mm. But what you were saying as well, you know, they're being accused of making up these claims. So girl A, in this complaint, in these criminal charges, she's already been awarded previously £27,500 for in 2018 because two other men who weren't involved in this trial admitted to sexually abusing her. So we already know, guaranteed, that two men have done that. We know that these people do not just work in pairs, they work in much larger groups, often shielded by the communities, but the defense have decided to pick up on that and say, well, these men weren't involved in it, you've just picked out their names because girl B was already doing all already had the names, and you're trying to jump on this so that you can get an extra $22,000 in compensation. To which she has said, I mean, do you think $22,000 is going to make up for all of the suffering that I went through this? I'm doing this because it's the truth. Yeah, because in her situation, you want justice. You want these people to go away. You get two people, it's nowhere near it. If it's potentially up to possibly exceeding 200 people who have abused her, it's a drop in the ocean to get two men. So if you can try and get the rest of them as well. But I just think, you know, it's understandable the defense lawyers are having to do what they do because that's their job. But still, it's awful that these girls have to continually go through this. When again, as we mentioned, they were so vulnerable that they thought it was normal to have sex with 30 men by the age of 13. It's vile. And, you know, I also found, because there's always stuff like this going on, especially in the areas of Greater Manchester, like Rochdale. Like, while I was looking into this, I stumbled upon this. So this is from the 25th of April, 2024. So last year right now, they were doing a child exploitation probe, where they were going around cracking down on places which are likely to have done this. And this was one, six males, suspects charged with being concerned in the supply of drugs, modern slavery charges, child exploitation. Names are exactly what you would expect. Azad Ali, Harris Ali, Adam Ali Sajjad. And I looked into this, and they were supposed to, as part of this article, it said that they were being taken to court to speak. I looked into this, couldn't find any follow-up on it at all. So who knows what's going on?
It's only been a year, Harry. You can't expect them beyond this.
Who knows what is going on?
Any child sex slavers operating in Rochdale?
If anybody in the audience, I might actually, you know, see about getting in touch with the courts to see if there was any follow-up on this, or speak to the police to see if there was any follow-up on this. If anybody in the audience knows if there was any follow-up on this, please let me know, because, I mean, this is just, again, six more to add to the list, potentially. And then there was also just this report as well of... asylum seeker followed a schoolgirl and raped her behind a pub in Falkirk town centre. This was Charlie Peters reporting earlier. The girl was collecting a prescription when she was approached by Sadek Nikzad, 29 years old, who assaulted her. So this is just what we come to expect now. This is the boon of multiculturalism that we have been gifted by our leaders. And it's awful. It's awful. And the fact that a lot of what we've been talking about was allowed to go on for so long, it was basically sanctioned by the authorities, is dreadful enough as it is, but the fact that we've not learnt those lessons and our leaders are still allowing the kind of policies that allow for this to go on is the greatest betrayal this country's ever known.
Yeah. But don't talk about it, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Because, you know, especially on Facebook.
I mean, to be honest with you, we probably won't be able to put this segment on YouTube.
Really?
Oh, yeah, I don't think so. We've been cavalier with our language. Not just you, but all of us.
Well, especially you.
By talking about these things in a straightforward, clear manner.
In an accurate way.
Yeah.
You know, you are right that these are Pakistani Muslim paedophile rape gangs, and that's naughty, say.
Well, I got cancelled by the feminists. Like, my first round of cancelling was by a group of left-wing women who said that I had questionable views on race because I talked about grooming gangs. And I was so right. And so many of them that attacked me then had to concede later. One of them is a massive grifter. But she was like, oh, it's all rapes. And I was like, no, it's definitely in grooming gangs. They are overrepresented. Pakistani men, Muslim men are overrepresented.
It's a particular pattern of behaviour.
Yeah, well, I think it's also like with the close connections and the cousin marriages and the fact that one person will have many connections to you. Sometimes it's all of those men in that one room with that victim. And I wonder if that doesn't lend itself somehow to the culture and to maintaining such a... Because most people wouldn't keep it secret, right? If you were doing that sort of thing, that would leak out. But and maybe it leaks out to their community and nobody cares.
Well, I've said this before, like I could, there's no one on my phone that I could ring to say, right, I've got this girl. There's no one on my phone I could ring and say, do you want to come over and have a turn on a 12-year-old girl? Like, they'd be,
well, he wouldn't go.
Exactly. They'd be like, are you? I'm calling the cops.
Yeah, man. I'd call the police. Yeah.
How? Yeah, exactly. Well, obviously, you know, and yet this is such a perennial and normalized thing where it's like, it's a way of keeping each other loyal.
Yeah, she's also not a girl, is she? For them, she's not. She's a vessel at which they can exert their hatred of us.
Yeah. That is genuinely what it comes down to. Anyway, we'll skip the video comments today, Samson, just because we've only got 10 minutes left. And then it's Harry's fault.
Oh, it's my fault, is it? Oh, right.
It's fine. It's not your fault. I'm joking.
We do have some more Rumble rants that we've not gone through.
Go on, you go through those.
Yeah. Habsification again says, come join an Eastern Orthodox church, the original church, apparently. Sigil Stone says, consanguineous is somewhat misleading because it's an umbrella term. They're not marrying cousins and it's not mother or son. Saying any further would get you prosecuted for hate speech in Europe. And Sigil Stone again says, I don't know how London ever managed to elect someone named Sad Dick Khan.
Well, London's 37% English, so that should tell you everything you need to know. Michael says, Kelly J is always a magnificent guest. She's a breath of fresh air in stark contrast to what we see in the women in the mainstream media.
Well, thanks.
Luke says, I got Islander 3 less than 24 hours after ordering. Massive improvement. So we had a problem with the Islander 2. The distributor we used for one was fine, no problems. And for some reason with two, I'm guessing they like lost a pallet of the things or something. But they didn't say, they just didn't deliver like a third.
I hope they don't notice.
Yeah, like they just didn't deliver them. And so we got loads of people saying, where's my thing? And I'm like, I don't know, it's all been sent. And so we changed delivery company and this one's been really, really good, apparently, because there are loads of people who are like, oh, how's it here? My copy of Island 3 arrived, you know, wish I'd got one and two and stuff like this. So that's glad to hear that.
What's that next?
What?
Somebody's named themselves Harry Robinson Drowning Orphans.
What? Yeah, I don't know.
That's a very... That's a new one. I know we get lots of jokey names, but that's a new one.
So, well, he says, my Islander arrived yesterday and said to my friends, we both love the magazine, especially the article on Eowyn. You've read Lord of the Rings, right?
Yeah.
Well, hey, in there, there's an article called Marshals of Middle-Earth. The first two were on Boromir and Faramir, and Luke has done one on Eowyn. Now, so that's, I haven't actually had time to read it yet, but there's lots of good stuff in there.
Really is very beautiful.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, Rory does an absolutely tremendous job with the graphic design of the whole thing.
Yeah, it's really good. He says, I can't help but think that if we applied the logic of I drink tea, therefore I'm English, to any other ethnic group, that would be considered racist. Imagine saying I eat curry, therefore I'm Indian. I had a Chinese on Friday.
I was going to say, I ate curry the other day, actually, so...
We can't get a decent Chinese where I live.
Really?
For love nor money, no.
Well, I didn't say it was a decent Chinese.
Oh, okay.
It was crap. But, you know, I hope they don't watch this. Charlie says, funny how the same people who claim that anyone can be English 5 minutes ago were saying the English are hateful racists and the flag's a symbol of the far right. Yeah, I know. Aren't we like an evil, oppressive, white supremacist, imperial people? Why do you want to be part of us?
They're just as English as I am. They owe reparations too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But do they? Do they? No, I don't think they'd like that part of being English, would they?
Someone online says, if he was Anglo-Saxon, he would be English, quote. Yes, article. If he was English, then he would be English. That's correct.
Well, that was the funny thing when I was reading through it. I was like, okay, this is rubbish. Oh, they concede my point.
Yeah.
They always get to that part. It's the same with Politics Joe, where they were like, they get past the bit, oh, it's so racist and terrible. But I suppose if you're Anglo-Saxon, then you can make a claim of being English that's a little bit better than just saying, oh, I drink tea. And then by the end of it, they're starting to go, where's the English Parliament?
Yeah.
I thought they were British. I thought I was always quite cool for saying I was English because I like being English. But I thought everyone was British and that was the nice thing that we were, you know, you could have a British passport, but not an English one.
Well, I mean, we're stateless people. We don't have a state. And as you can see, the British state loves Islam and foreigners. Yeah. So we're in a bit of trouble, to be honest. Anyway, Sophie says, I do think it helps that the English are actually a super distinct culture. Sophie's Danish. She says, I know Carla's not a big fan of anime, but there's actually a lot of Japanese animes and games that are super obsessed with England and go out of their way to portray a fairy tale like England with top hats, tea, and gentlemen codes of honour and behaviour. And while it's a Japanese interpretation of England, it's so distinctly English. You see it and say, man, this butler keeping a beautiful mansion and laying the cutlery out correctly and serving tea and finger food is so incredibly English. Well, the thing is, like, often the people outside of your culture can do a much better job of enunciating what your culture is than you, because it's strange and foreign, so they notice all of the things about you that you don't notice about yourself.
We need to return to being the England that Japan wishes we still
were. Absolutely.
And have you seen that? You've seen that thing with the Japanese ambassador to Wales recently, right?
It's amazing.
He loves it. Yeah. He loves Wales. He loves the culture. Yeah. He's so kind and he seems to be really deferential to everything.
And just respectful.
Yeah, it's really sweet.
But he is Japanese, so that is that's the whole less. Culture, isn't it?
Yeah, but
it's really sweet, though. That's why I like
it's
the
very
Japanese.
Nice.
Yeah.
But Fuzzy Toaster says, I was born in Singapore. I was raised an expat. My parents are English and Irish. This idiocy from the left can be countered with something as simple as the horse and stable argument.
They get really annoyed at that one.
I love the pantomime.
They've got no counter to.
Pantomime horses or horses one. That's my favorite one. It came out of the anti-trans movement where it's like, you know, trans women. Oh yeah, pantomime horses or horses. That's so good. Mm. And it's exactly the point.
Seahorses are horses as well.
Yeah, it's another good one. Yeah. So it's just one of those things where it's like, look, we can all tell that the essential characteristics of the thing are not what you're claiming. So essentially what you're saying is, I'd like you to buy into my pleasant fiction. And it's like, okay, maybe one day I might be inclined to do so. But right now, while Sadiq Khan is saying I'm an Englishman, I'm not inclined to buy into the pleasant fiction. You know, those days are gone, I'm afraid.
You could say a nice English rose these days was like a man who pretends to be a woman. A black man who pretends to be a woman is a quintessential English rose.
It only makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Just for the person in the chat, Carl ate a Chinese yesterday. Chinese food, right? I didn't say food.
Did he stutter?
Chanavi says, yes, ban curries and marriages, please. I agree with Posey. The idea that the host country has to change laws to accommodate the guests is absurd. If you're a guest in a country, you follow the laws of that country regardless of what your religion says. And again, the same with, like, you know, religiously motivated animal slaughters. Yeah, I mean, we are allowed to do this. It's not wrong for us to do this. In fact, it's wrong for us not to do this, because otherwise we would do it the way they do it, and we've decided the way they do it is barbaric. I mean, you've watched the halal slaughters, right? Mm. It's awful. Yeah, stun the animal first. And you know, anyway, it really bothers me that we just concede everything all the time. Thane Scotty says, just today, while waiting for the podcast to start, a local reverend came to buy donuts. He had a rainbow lanyard, tattoos, and a pin reading gay.
What would Jesus do?
I'm sure he'd be all right with it.
That's just so...
Sure.
Outside of anything else, that's just embarrassing to walk around with, surely.
Yeah, I know, right?
I'm just constant symbols of, look at me, look at me, look at who I am, look at what I think. Shut up.
I just don't know why he's so, like, insistent that we all have to know that he has sex with men. I have things up my ass. Okay, great.
It's really gross. You know, I don't need to know that.
Yeah, it's good for you.
Please don't tell me. Yeah.
Well, either way, you just don't need to know anything, do you? You don't need to say, you know, I have sex on a Tuesday.
Yeah, I'm going to get my little lanyard.
It's always the most unwelcome conversation at the pub when my mates start saying what they've been up to. I'm like, no.
No. Nobody's. It's like your dreams, love. Nobody's interested in your sex life or your dreams.
Grant says, my pastor said to me yesterday before Ash Wednesday service that so many denominations are just secular humanism in a Christian costume. That's the Church of England. 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is 100% of it. I would have to say, I'm not sure about just cramming atheists into pews as good. I think it's good if you're an atheist and you try to raise your children Christian. I agree, but I think at least doing something like, you know, making the churches have an attendance is a good start.
Well, just it's a community thing. It's not, you know, it is the kingdom of God, but it is a community thing. And so belonging to a community will save us all.
So, yeah. Kevin makes a great point there, where Keir Starmer's like, the Muslim community is unbelievably charitable. They do the most amount of charity. Kevin points out, yeah, they do charities that help Muslims. They don't do like broad ranging charity to normal, you know, non-Muslim people.
Yeah.
They only help other Muslims. And it's like, don't get me wrong, good for you. Maybe we should do something similar. But he points out, the Salvation Army said they would only help Christians. You bet they'd be called lots of names, which they would.
There's Islamic Relief. You should look into them, another program. It's far too long to discuss, but they've got loads of posters and billboards all over London at the moment. And they are they've got ties with banned groups.
Oh, do they? Well, what a shock. Darth Trekkia says, when will we see the royal family adopting a burqa? Now, this is interesting because there is a rumour that something like 20 years ago, King Charles, or Prince Charles when he was then, went to Turkey and converted to Islam. Now, I don't have any proof of this, right? But I've seen like lots of people posting like, you know, old things that suggest that he may have done. Like I said, I don't know whether it's true. But like the way he acts, I can believe it. Yeah. He seems to really love the Muslim community.
I wonder what it is about it.
No idea.
Maybe it's power, because he's such a weak man.
Maybe. I think it's... So there's a bit that's like... Remember, he remembers the Empire, right? You know, he's used to having foreign people, like, you know, and being, like, congenial with foreign people. And it's like, okay, but the Empire's gone, so, oh, well, bring them here, I guess. You know, recreate the British Empire in England.
Well, wasn't that public stoning just perfectly wonderful?
Oh, God, yeah.
Isn't it great?
Jerome says, medieval Muslims just wanted free movement across Europe, but the evil European knights stopped them. Yes, that's exactly how the history books teach the Crusades, actually, I imagine. Yeah, the idea that he's saying, oh yeah, we got the idea of free movement and open borders from Spain, it's like...
I'd argue that most children have no idea about the word Crusades, let alone what they were.
Sorry, my sons do.
Well, yours will, yeah.
I teach them about Richard the Lionheart.
I'm sure they will, but not many.
Yeah. Swamp Dweller says, the Eastern Orthodox Church is the only Christian church I've seen that hasn't fully converted to the Woke Brigade. The liturgical traditions can be traced back to the birth of Christianity. However, most of the churches in the West have been founded by Eastern European immigrants and still carry the holdovers of local origins. Mm. I mean, like, the Eastern Orthodox Church is kind of, it's very mystical. You've seen the services and
what? No, I don't think I have.
Oh, check it out. Like, it's very, the churches themselves are beautiful. And the services are very exotic, and they feel like Eastern mystery religion sort of service, you know, with lots of incense and smoke and chanting. It is cool. It's very alien, though.
Well, my friend has just joined the Russian Orthodox.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's Greek Orthodox as well, aren't there? And they both seem a little bit before. There's a whole... I expect you know about it. There's a whole thing about the Vatican is actually the... is Satan's answer to Christianity, and that, and there's all this sort of symbolism. I have no idea. I'm just saying. I'm just
someone with a theology degree.
I'm just reporting back.
David says, attractive women often get lighter sentences than unattractive or plain-looking women for the same crimes.
I know. I got off scot-free from the murder.
There we go. This is a general thing, though. Attractive people get an easier time in society. It's just the way the world works.
Yeah.
Simon says, how about an easy meat book club? That is not a bad idea.
I am considering it once I've finished it, yeah.
Maureen says, regarding the girls who can't recall how many men have used them, repression is a neat defense mechanism that makes sure you don't mentally break when you recall things from the past. Happens with a lot of children, especially in abusive situations. It's just your mind trying to make sure you survive. That is particularly unfair. Like, I can't even imagine, like, how could you be a defense lawyer in this sort of case? I mean, I know they're legally entitled to one. Someone has to do it, but like, yeah. So I spent my afternoon trying to intimate that this victim of child rape was a lying whore who's just on drugs.
Although they probably square it that I've been spending my afternoon trying to make sure that our justice system.
Yeah, they would. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our justice system made sure that rapist didn't go to jail.
It's Keir's world. We're just living in it.
It is. And, Baron von Warhawk says, the British nation-state used to be able to defend the world from Napoleon, Kaiser, and Hitler. Now it can't even defend its children from foreign rapists with the IQ of a Neanderthal. But I'm actually kind of sick of this Neanderthal bashing, right? There's nothing to suggest Neanderthals are stupid. They had larger brains than we did, actually. And I think it's unfair to compare them to foreign rapists. And
some suggest that our Neanderthal admixture is one of the things that makes us stand out.
Exactly. So there's nothing wrong with Neanderthals. We probably bred them out of existence.
A man with a brow like mine can't do much Neanderthal bashing.
But right, Posey, well, Kelly, thank you for joining us. Where can people find more of you?
letwomenspeak.org, or you can find me on Twitter, where I'm X, at the Posey Parker. What?
I don't like the name change.
Oh, X, it's ridiculous. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Sorry, at the Posey Parker, was it?
At the Posey Parker, yes. I'm everywhere, actually, so come and find me.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, and we will see you tomorrow. Oh, wait, Calvin's Common Sense Crusade is in half an hour, so come and watch that.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase